Bill Belichick. I'm a Patriots fan as well as a Cowboy fan. Caleb tells me I can't be both. But really, in my heart of hearts, I'm not one or the other. I'm really a Houston Oilers fan that doesn't have a team anymore. So in lieu of rooting for the Oilers, because the Titans, they're dead to me. I have my AFC team, which is the Patriots, and I have my NFC team, which is the Cowboys. So most of you know that this fella here is the head coach for the New England Patriots. Obviously, he's very successful in his goal, which is to win Super Bowls. And they say that he succeeds in large measure because he ignores what he might like to do, and he plans his games according to the strengths and weaknesses of the assets that he has at his disposal. A lot of coaches, what they'll do is they'll design and implement systems regardless of who's on their team, and they make their team fit the system. But Bill Belichick uses his strengths and weaknesses of his team to design and implement his systems. He makes his strategy fit his resources. I think this fella clearly understands in principle what we are taught in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 19 through 23, principles about adaptability. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win more. To the Jews I became as a Jew so that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, as though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that I may by all means save some. I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. I'm kind of tongue-tied, but what I want to talk about in this morning's lesson is this text and its main principle, which is our need for adaptability, our need for adaptability. Paul obviously was a very adaptable man. It says in this text, he made himself a slave to all. He became as a Jew to those who were Jews. He became to cultural Jews. He became as under law to those who were religious Jews. He became as without law to those who did not have law. He became as weak to those who were weak. He became all things to all men. Why? Why did he do all this? It was so that he might, by all means, save more than otherwise would be saved. Now, does this mean Paul compromised the gospel? Absolutely not. A good example of that is when it came to the circumcision of Timothy and Titus. Timothy, he went ahead and circumcised. Titus, he did not. And why is that? Well, it's because it's not wrong to be circumcised unless somebody says you have to be circumcised. And so it was effective for him to go ahead and baptize Timothy so that he would remove obstacles that he would know that could anticipate being in his way. But he didn't do that to Titus because people were saying, Titus, you got to do it. And so he was not going to compromise the truth, not at all. A couple of quotes to kind of put that in context. Herndahl in the pulpit commentary said, Paul was the most compliant in things indifferent, but most unyielding in things essential. When he yielded, he not only confined himself to things indifferent, which was like the idea of circumcision. Circumcision is a matter of indifference, as long as somebody's not binding it on you. But he made it to be understood that the things that he adapted himself to were indifferent. When they were regarded as essential, he refused to comply. This is strikingly illustrated in his permitting the circumcision of Timothy, but resisting the circumcision of Titus. So what does it mean then? If it doesn't mean that he compromised, what does it mean? It means that he removed hindrances to the preaching of the gospel whenever he possibly could. This passage does not express a wish to please men, but a desire to remove every hindrance to the reception of the gospel. There's a vital principle in this text, and I'm just recently starting to clue in on it, and really much too late in my life, am I beginning to understand, appreciate, and apply what this principle is. And the principle is this: to be as effective as you possibly can, you got to adapt your approach to a goal according to the unique circumstances that you face. In other words, effectiveness is not a one-size-fits-all proposition. And that's certainly true when it comes to winning souls and other spiritual pursuits. We've got to be adaptable. As one put it, Paul became all things to all men in order to realize his supreme object. Personal predilections must be sacrificed and unpleasant restraints submitted to if we would do effectively the greatest work under heaven. An unbending preacher will preach to unbroken hearts. A preacher who insisted on doing it his way, regardless of whether that's most effective for his audience or not, is going to preach to unbroken hearts. An insistence upon our rights and privileges is a short method often adopted of ruining all hope. Because we insist upon doing it our way, we often bar and bolt the very door that we're trying to unfasten. I think that's exactly right. One more thought and we'll get to applications. He said, in great natures you meet with remarkable combination of firmness and yieldingness. If you're going to be good at something, you've got to be firm in some things and yielding in others. To do a great work in the world, a man needs a powerful will, a resolution not easily moved. But at the same time, he needs a flexibility of disposition, a readiness to adapt himself to different characters and to changing circumstances. Without the determination which approaches obstinacy, he will not keep the one aim before him. Without the pliancy needed in dealing with men, he will not be able to secure the aim. So you gotta keep the aim that you're searching for firmly in your focus, and not give up on what you're pursuing. But you have to be flexible enough to know that there are many scriptural ways to achieve the end, and you got to be adaptable so you do whatever's best in the circumstances you find yourself in. I realized that very quickly when I moved to Northwest Arkansas. They're not you, and you're not them. And so I've had to do some changing, and I hope it's been for the better, because if you're going to be effective, you've got to be able to be adaptable. You've got to be adaptable in every relationship of life, brethren. Whether we're talking about our spouse, our children, our parents, our friends, our enemies, our coworkers, or our schoolmates, our brethren, whoever, Jesus fully expects us, like Paul, to do all we possibly can without compromising the gospel, to spread it as effectively as possible into the hearts of the lost and even further into the hearts of the saved. And you do that, we do that, by understanding the principle that's in this text, by appreciating the principle that's in this text, and by applying the principle that is in this text. Brethren, we've got to learn, without compromising the truth, to be flexible in our approach to preaching so that we can be effective as we possibly can. So with that introduction, let's talk about some things that we must do to become all things to all men. And there's at least five things we've got to do if we're going to become all things to all men. First of all, we've got to make ourselves servants of all. We've got to make ourselves servants of all. And if we're going to do that, we have to understand, first of all, the place of service in the Christian's life. You can't be a Christian and not be a servant. Look at Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3. If we're going to be servants, if we're going to be Christians, if we're going to be like Jesus, it's not about us, it's about others, and it's about Him. Philippians 2, 3 says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking on the form of a bondservant. So here God is becoming a servant. He's becoming a slave. So obviously there's an important role for servitude in Christian living. It says, he emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even the death on the cross. Jesus was a servant, and he expects us to do the same. Look at Romans chapter 15 and verse 1. Romans 15 and verse 1. We who are strong ought to bear with the weaknesses of those who are without strength, and not just please ourselves. There are times when we say, man, I know the best way to do something. Well, that may be the case if you had the right people to do it with. No matter how smart you may be and how great your plan, if it doesn't fit the people you're trying to help, it's not going to work. You've got to be adaptable. You may not want to have to put up with weak folks, but you have to adapt to them if you're going to help them. Now we who are strong ought to bear with the weaknesses of those who are without strength and not just please ourselves. Each of us is to please his neighbor for his good, to his edification. For even Christ did not please himself. We've got to be servants. Look at 1 Corinthians 10, 24. If you're going to adapt, you got to see yourself as a servant. As a servant. It's not about you. It's about others. It's about God and other people. 1 Corinthians 10, 24 says, let no one seek his own but the good of his neighbor. So it's our task to adapt to them. It's not their job to adapt to us. Drop down to verse 31. Whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many so that they may be saved. So we've got to understand the role and the place of service in the Christian life. And it's a blessing, brethren. A lot of times we're reluctant to serve others, to adapt to others, because we want them to adapt to us, thinking that, you know what, the way to be really happy is to get everybody to line up with me. But what the Scripture says, what Jesus says, what our Lord says, that it is more blessed to give than to receive there in Acts 20 and 35. And we need to get that through our thick heads. Who is truly happy? It is the person who will pattern himself according to circumstances so that he might bless others, and not those who demand that reality fits or conforms to their desires. And certainly this is a necessity. This is not an optional matter we're talking about at all. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 23. This is the very end of our text that we're looking at, 1 Corinthians 9, 23. When Paul talked about becoming all things to all men, this was not optional. He says, I do all things for the sake of the gospel so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. So servitude is what it is all about if we are a Christian. And if we're going to adapt, we've got to first understand that. It's not about us. It's about others. It's not about other people changing to fit us. It's about us changing to fit other people. And again, not talking about changing the gospel, but changing within the parameters of righteousness our approach to sharing the gospel so that it'll be most readily received by whoever it is that we're talking about. So that's the first principle we've got to appreciate. Second principle we've got to appreciate is that effective service depends as much on how we render service as what service we render. Very important point. Very important point. It's tough sometimes to get this through people's heads. It's not just about what we say. It's also about how we say it. Look at Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 18. Some things need to be said. But we've got to consider, we've got to stop and tell people, ask ourselves, what's the best way for me to communicate this to the people that need to hear it? Some people might need a heavy hand. Some save as though fire. Other people may need more gentleness. It just depends on the person you're dealing with. Everybody's different. So you got to think how, not just what. Proverbs 12:18, there is one who speaks rashly like the thrust of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. The first half of the verse, the guy's saying what needs to be said. He's just saying it in a way that makes it so that the people that need to hear it turn their ears off before they even consider the message that's being presented because of the way that it's being presented. Look at Proverbs 15, verse 1. Proverbs 15, verse 1. And I've seen this so often. Maybe there's a message that the elders need to bring to the church. But you got to stop and say, not only is this what needs to be said, but how do I say it best? A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge acceptable, but the mouth of fools spout folly. It's not just what, it's how. Look at verse 28. Such an important point. And the Proverbs go through this over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. The heart of the righteous ponders how to answer. Not just what to say, but how to say it. But the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things. And we can go on and on. Look at chapter 16, verse 21. This is a really good passage to mark in your scriptures if you haven't got it marked as far as adapting ourselves to the most effective way of presenting the gospel or presenting reproof or instruction or correction in righteousness' sake. Proverbs chapter 16, 21 says, the wise in heart will be called understanding. We'll understand the principles that we're talking about here, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. We've got to understand that. Understanding that is a fountain of life to one who has it, but the discipline of fools is folly. The discipline of fools is folly. So you got to understand, it's not just what, it's how. The heart of the wise instructs his mouth and adds persuasiveness to his lips. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. It's not just what, it's how. And it's a clear New Testament principle too. Look at Colossians chapter 4, verse 5. Colossians chapter 4, verse 5. Conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. There's a lot of imagery in the idea of our words being like salt. But one thing is that salt does is make things palatable. Tammy gets on me for using salt sometimes. But it just makes things taste better. It makes things you got to eat go down smoother. And that's what we need to do if we're going to be adaptable folks. We got to appreciate that it's just not about what we do. It is how we do it that is vitally important. And I would say one is just as important as the other. A third principle that we've got to get if we're going to be adaptable is that effective service varies from person to person. We're not all the same. People in one group are different than other people in other groups. Cultural Jews are different than religious Jews. Jews are different than Gentiles. The weak are different than the strong. Women are different from men. Adults are different from children. Normans are different than Lawsons. We're just different. We're not all the same. It's not one size fits all. And even people within a group are different from other people in the same group. Within the group of Christians, Brooks back there is not the same as Gary. As far as the group of preachers go, Wayne is not Tim. As far as the group of Normans is concerned, Tim is not Caleb. Caleb is not Tim. And I just want to clarify this point right quick. In raising Caleb, a lot of y'all would say the problem was y'all two were just too much alike. Let me say he's doing really well. I'm proud of my son. He's married. He's serving the Lord. He's got a beautiful child, just bought a home, got a good job. He's doing really well. But everybody was telling me that we were just so much alike. He called me up about a year or so ago. He said, Dad, get on the line and take this personality test. 5 indications of personality. 1, we were as close as 2 people could possibly be. 1, we were exactly alike. The other 4, we couldn't be more different if we tried. Tim and Caleb are different. Wayne, as elders, and Gary are different. As far as preachers go, Brooks and Randy, we're all different, even though we're in the same group. And I didn't appreciate that reality until very late, especially in the parenting game. For the most part, I raised my kids the way that would have worked for me, but not the way that would have worked best for them. Usually I raised my kids the way I wanted to raise them, not the way they needed to be raised. Now, I remember one time, and I'm sure you've probably had this same situation, you look at your kids and someone, one of them is misbehaving, and you sit there and you go, I can't believe you're doing that. You know, I raised you just like I did the other ones. Why are you doing that when they didn't? I used that line on Caleb one time, and he looked me right in the eye and said, that was really dumb, Dad. And you know what? He was exactly right. He says, I'm nothing like the girls. You should have raised me totally different than the way you raised the girls. And he was right. He was right. He wasn't me. And instead of trying to raise him as if he were Tim, I needed to raise him as he was, which was Caleb. And luckily, the Lord has been blessing us, and we've gotten through our raisings, and life is going on. Just to kind of give you an update, everybody's doing well. 4 grandchildren, 1's in heaven, 3 are still with us, and they're beautiful. Jay admitted that they're beautiful. He said they're not quite as beautiful as his grandkids. We can talk about that later. But everybody's doing well. We're really proud of everybody. But that was a principle that I needed to have appreciated a long time before I did when it comes to the parenting game. And it's a principle that we need to appreciate that affects all facets of effective service. You got to realize that when it comes to doing what's best and being most effective, it's not one size fits all. Everybody's different. Everybody's different. The golden rule is not to do to others as you would have them do to you if they were you, but if you were them. Let me repeat that. The golden rule is not to do to others as you would have them do to you if they were you, but do unto others as you would have them do to you if you were them. In other words, I believe wholeheartedly that the golden rule requires us to put ourselves in other people's shoes, to see life from their perspective instead of making them conform to what we would prefer ourselves. So the third principle of effectiveness is that we've got to appreciate that everybody's different. Everybody's different. And I guess I'm kind of getting all wound up and sped up, and I'm running through this pretty quick. Might have some time for questions and answers. But you know what? As soon as I say that, it never happens. It never happens. So don't give up on me yet. Number 4. We got to become students of other people. We got to become students of other people. If we want to serve people as effectively as possible, we've got to take the time to get inside their heads and their hearts and learn what it's like to walk in their shoes. For then and only then can we formulate a strategy that's going to maximize the chances of success. People are different. There's no doubt about that. But we can learn a whole lot about people no matter how different they may be from us. We may have no point of reference, but we can find them and we can understand. I'll never forget, turn to 1 Peter 3:7. I remember one time back in Lafayette, you probably heard me tell this story. We read 1 Peter 3:7, which says, "You husbands in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone who is weaker since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life so that your prayers will not be hindered." I said, admittedly, husbands, you know, what is it, men are Venus, women are Mars, or vice versa, something like that. Men and women, totally different beings, totally different planets. But this scripture says what? Husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. I was making the point. Husbands, if you want to understand your wife badly enough, you can. You can do it. And then I was shaking hands after the sermon. The guy held out his hand and said, "Shake my hand, please. Shake my hand, please." I shook it. Okay, okay. And he says, "I just wanted to shake the hand of a man who said he could understand women." It's not that we can't understand people. It's that we don't want to learn. And that's really the problem. That's the reason you have a lot of problems in marriages. It's because what do? To get a spouse, we woo them. We clean up our act. We clean up the car. We buy them gifts. We open the doors for them. We send them flowers. We do all those kind of things to get them. Why? So that we can keep on serving them like that? No, we do all that to get them so once we say I do, they can start serving me. The reason you have a lot of problems in marriage is because the partners want the other ones to change for them. They're not willing to change for the other person. You can't be like that. And so one of the big excuses that people use is, "I just couldn't do it even if I wanted to." And that's just a lie. It's just a lie. There are all kinds of resources. One of the best things to do to learn about people is to just listen. Just listen. Shut up and listen. If that's not a good thing for adults to say, young folks, just be quiet and listen. One of our elders in Springdale, salesman, and he says, "Whenever I go on a sales call, I do my utmost to just to be quiet and listen and watch. Because they will, in the course of our interaction, they'll tell me what I need to do to sell them on my product, if I'll just listen." And that's true, brethren. People will tell us what they need for us to do for them if we'll just listen. Body language can be some of the most effective forms of communication. Just watch. You can tell what works and what doesn't work if you just care enough to observe. But there are other resources available. There's all kinds of different personality profile tests that you can take. And it's very interesting. I think it's really good for a marriage relationship. Take one of those things. One of my friends lives in Tulsa, who I have a camp with now. His father is he's a friend too. Don't mean to say he's not. But he was a fireman. He was, I think, the assistant fire chief for one of the towns there in Tulsa area. I forget which one. Broken Arrow. And what they would do is to have all of the firemen take what the FBI had developed, was which they called DISC, D-I-C-S-K-C. I'm not exactly sure what the acronym stands for. But basically what it does is it takes a person, and there's a whole range of different personality profiles. And you take this test, and it basically teaches you about who you are. And then if you share that information with somebody else, it tells them who you are too. It tells you your inclinations, your strengths, your weaknesses, so that you can adapt to others in the best possible way. That's why they give the FBI agents, because FBI agents, a lot of times, they'll have to go to various places and deal with all kinds of different people. And their goal is to solve crime. Not to do it their way, to do it whatever way needs to be done within the bounds of lawfulness to get the crime solved. And so the better they understand the people they're dealing with, the more effectively they can get from them what they need. And Steve Jarrett, he said that, you know, that we, our firemen need the same thing because we have the same task. So there are resources out there. Books you can read. The Five Love Languages is a good book. You know, people communicate love and receive love different ways. Read a book. You know, there's a lot of books about parenting out there. If you have a kid that's stubborn as a mule and you just don't get them, there's a book called Strong-Willed Child by James Dobson I think is very helpful. So there's resources out there, brethren. If we want to become students of other people, if we want to become adaptable and help other people like we should, you got to study people. You got to learn who people are. And what do you got to do to get to do that? What do you got to do to do that? Well, first of all, you got to see yourself as a servant, right? You got to see yourself as one who adapts to others, not as one who insists that other people adapt to them. You realize that it's not just about what you do, it's how you do it. You realize that everybody is different. They're not all the same. And so if we're going to figure out how to best help people, you got to learn the people you're trying to help. You got to learn them. And finally, we've got to objectively evaluate our service. We've got to objectively evaluate our service. It's a very difficult thing to do. Boy, isn't that hard. If we're going to be effective, we've got to objectively look at what we're doing and ask ourselves, is it really working the best it possibly can? Or are there things that I need to tweak and there are things that I need to change? Look at Proverbs 14 and verse 8. Proverbs 14 and verse 8. The wisdom of the sensible is to understand his way, but the foolishness of fools is deceit. The wisdom of the sensible is to understand his way, but the foolishness of fools is deceit. If we want to be wise, we're going to objectively know ourselves, what we're doing, and we're going to be willing to say to ourselves, you know what, this is working, this is not working, and change where we should. And that should not be a problem for us if we're servants. If it's not about us, if it's about other people, it shouldn't be a problem for us to be objective about the effectiveness of what we do. And one of the best resources that we can possibly find for figuring out whether or not what we're doing is effective or not is criticism. Criticism. It is a great asset to this end. We resent people who criticize us, and we need to get over that. First of all, we should expect it. How many here serve people perfectly? Raise your hand. Go ahead. So you mean you got room to improve? So why are you so shocked when somebody suggests, well, maybe this is one way you might do that? Shouldn't shock us that people have suggestions for our improvement. We should be thankful that they love us enough to give them to us. And frankly, one of the best resources of criticism is our enemies. I certainly appreciate constructive criticism whenever it's offered, but you know what? One of the most valuable forms of criticism is destructive criticism. The ones you should really listen to are the ones that hate your guts. Because a lot of times what they're going to do is they're going to be brutal, but they're going to be brutally honest. That's not always the case. As I've put it in times past, and I'm sure you've heard me say this before, is that in 95% of criticism, there's something in that that if you listen to and you hear it and you heed it, you can become a better servant. Now, you know, 4 to 5% of the time, it's going to be totally, completely, and utterly off base. But listen to criticism. Appreciate it. Value it. Expect it. Don't get mad about it. That's what we do, isn't it? I don't think the way you did that was the best possible way. What are you saying? Come on. Of course it is. See, they haven't even told us why they think what we did wasn't the most effective thing. We've just heard that we're about to get criticized, so we're already mad and we've already got our fists up. We're ready for a fight. And we just got to get over that. Sometimes our automatic reaction to criticism is to say, uh-uh, not true. And then if that doesn't work, the next one is usually, Well, you do it too. And all that's just childish ways of responding to criticism. When somebody criticizes us, instead of getting mad, we ought to start listening intensely. And criticism can come in different forms. It can come not only in words, verbal criticism, but it also can come in actions. Preachers, for example. We like to talk. Now, I'm doing good. I'm kind of stretching this out so we cover the time. Don't expect that throughout the rest of this week. I got up here a little nervous, and so I started talking real fast, but I'm calming down now, getting comfortable again. But preachers, we like to talk. And talk. And talk. And you know, I mean, I just did a meeting in Kerrville, Texas. One of the last night of the meeting, I probably talked for 50 minutes to an hour, but I promise you, we were all together till the end. I mean, everybody was listening. They invited me back, so maybe I'm not too far off on that basis, too far off on that assessment. But there's a lot of times when I talk for an hour. I try not to do that very regularly. But frankly, there's some times I talk 20 minutes and I should have shut up 10 minutes ago. And you can tell as a preacher if you'll just look at your audience. Body language is really clear. You know, people start, you know, instead of being like this, they're like this. Or they're like this. Or they're fidgeting. You can tell whether you're being effective or not by looking at reactions. Like I said before, so much of communication is nonverbal. Be students of people. Look for criticism not only in words but also in reactions. And I would suggest to you not only do we need to watch for it, but we also need to seek it out. It's tough to hear. It's not easy on the ego. Because you want to survey folks and say, what could I do better? And you know the response you want, right? Tim, you couldn't do anything better if you tried, man. You're everything. You're all right. Don't change a thing, buddy. You've arrived. It doesn't work that way. You go to people and you say, you know, what do I need to improve? They'll give you some really good ideas. So go to people. Don't just passively wait for them to come to you. Go to them. Friend of mine, and I probably told you this story too. I mean, I was here 16 years. Probably every story in my retinue, y'all know. But you may recall the story of my good friend Randy Thomas back in Tucson, Arizona. He had two girls that he was trying to raise, and he was trying to figure out the best way to do it. So what he did was he picked out some of the people that had produced the best kids that he could find, and he went to them and sat them down and said, look, tell me what you think I need to do to get where you ended up being. And that's really smart, because a lot of times the ones that offer you the criticism are the ones who are least capable of doing what they're telling you to do. There's a lot of armchair quarterbacks, and usually it's the ones that are most arrogant that the ones that did the worst job are the ones that are going to tell you how to do it. The ones that are really good are usually the ones that say, what do I know? They focus more on their mistakes than their successes, and they're very reluctant to tell anybody else what they ought to do because they're confident they don't know themselves. So go out and find those people and ask them and talk to them. I was just talking to the elders last week. We had a family leave us in Springdale, a young family. Just a total shock. I mean, just the fact that they were leaving, much less where they ended up going, was not even on the radar. They did it without warning, without explanation, without saying goodbye. They were just gone. And so I'm working with a young man who wants to be a preacher on a regular basis, just having a Bible class with him. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you think our church needs to do in order to improve? And I tell you what, this sharp young man, he gave me things that I had not even considered before. And it struck me, you know what, we need to do that on a regular basis. Elders need to survey their congregations. Teachers need to survey their students. Husbands need to survey their wives. Parents need to survey their children. Look for feedback. Go out and actively garner it. Because what you'll find is that there will be patterns emerging from the different sources that you glean. And if you survey 5, 6, 7 different people and all of them tell you the same thing, chances are overwhelming it's something that you need to work on. And give it a fair hearing. Give it a fair hearing. I recently shared some feedback with somebody, and the reaction was just what I had said before. Before I really even got the words out of my mouth, before there was even time to carefully consider what was said, the reaction was, well, we do that. That's not really fair to say. We've got to, when it comes to criticism, before you rule it out, presumptively rule it out, and then people have to basically force you to accept it, presumptively say, you know, there's probably something in this. What is it? I need to find it. Does that make sense? Look at Proverbs 12 and verse 15. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel. So what am I talking about here? I'm talking about a great resource for service, which is being adaptable. If you're going to be effective, you've got to be willing within the constraints of righteousness. You've got to be willing to change the way you do things in order to get it done the most effective way you possibly can. It's not an option. It's something that in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, our text 19 through 23, that God makes very, very clear. We have got to adapt to people so that we can be as effective as possibly can. And that requires 5 things at least to review. You gotta be a servant. It can't be about you. You gotta appreciate that it's not just what you do, it's how you do it. You got to appreciate that people are different. You got to become students of other people. And you've got to be able and willing to objectively evaluate what you're doing so that you can improve it when you need to. If we'll do all those things, we'll get it through our heads, you know what? We can be much more effective than we are. I'll close with a story. Sarah, when she was in college, and for those of you who don't know, I don't mean to take it for granted that you know my kids. Sarah's my middle kid. Caleb's my baby boy. He's not a baby anymore. He's 6'3". I have to look up to him. But when Sarah was in college, there was a class that she just did not want to take. She'd gone to a couple of times and wanted to drop it. And I said, no way, no how. You signed up for it? You go take that class. Then I went to lectures that year. And the teacher was one of the keynote speakers. And I'm sure he's a brilliant person. I'm sure he's brilliant beyond imagination. But I listened to him for about 5 minutes, and it was real clear that he did not care. I don't mean to besmirch his motivation. I'm not saying he didn't care about his audience, but he was not aware of his audience. Because he was speaking like he would to a group of PhDs presenting a doctoral dissertation. And you could tell very quickly that the group that he was talking to were not clued into what he was saying at all. And this guy is a smart guy. And he's an older fellow. So certainly by this place and time in his life, he should come to understand you got to adapt the way you teach things to the people you're teaching so that it'll be most readily well received. But this fella, more than anybody I've seen in a long, long time, taught me the lesson. You can't be clueless about your audience. You got to be understanding who you're talking to so that you can talk to them in the best possible way. So after about 10, 15 minutes of listening to this lecture, Sarah was about 3 seats down from me. She leaned forward and goes, Dad, psst, Dad. What? Can I drop the class now? Absolutely. Brethren, let's become all things to all men so that by all means we might save some. Got a little time. Is there any questions or comments, cheers or jeers? That's very true. And, you know, that's the way you can take the devil and turn what he thinks is going to be a great victory for him into his worst defeat. You know, criticism, God, the devil, you can use criticism to try to destroy you, but if you'll just listen to it and learn from it, you can take his best shot and end up being one of your best blows against him you've ever had. Very good point. Is that time? All right, thank you all, brethren. Look forward to the week.